I'm Fathery.
This is Dave.
And this is Text Trek.
Engage.
Welcome back aboard the Starship Texas for the 251st installment of the Text Trek podcast, the home of Star Trek fandom from deep in the heart of Texas, where we take a deep look at Star Trek, old and new. And tonight, we're talking about Star Trek Strange New Worlds, although arguably also an episode of Lower Decks, but Strange New Worlds, Season 2, Episode 7, Those Old Scientists, written by Catherine Lynn, who also used to write on Lower Decks. She made the transition to Strange New Worlds this season. And Bill Wokoff, who's, by the way, a WGA Union captain, I believe. He's one of the leaders out there on the picket line. So extra special shout out to Bill Wokoff.
And what's more, he's a union man.
Yes. And this was directed by Jonathan Frakes. So.
Absolutely.
So we got some veterans pulling their efforts together to bring this episode to us. It's definitely a special occasion episode. So it's going to be a real delight to talk about. But I have to acknowledge the wonderful people in the Text Trek Patreon who do make our show possible. So just a quick thank you to Starfleet Sohel, Cake is Eternal, Crazy Dutchie, Joanne Robertson, John Daw, Geek Filter, Earl Grey Trekkie, Quark Spar, Ben Genium, Stephanie Durantas, Matthew Averett, Braxton, and our anonymous supporters. We like to celebrate with our patrons every month by having our monthly Patreon watch party. Our next one is scheduled for August 12th. That's a Saturday. And we're going to be watching the Lower Decks episode, Hear All, Trust Nothing, which is also a crossover. That's the DS9 Lower Decks crossover episode, Season 3, Episode 6. And it's going to be a doubleheader. After that, we're going to toss on the Star Trek Prodigy episode, All the World's a Stage, which is kind of not a full-on crossover. It's definitely a tie-in to the original series. You know, we learned the fate of Ensign Garavik from Obsession, so for sure ties into TOS, so all kinds of crossover
fun.
Yeah,
all those people who'd been worried about Garavik over the years, you know, have finally had their questions answered.
I don't know if Sohel is with us in the live audience, but he was legit worried about Garavik.
So. Hey, you know, everybody is somebody's favorite character. It's nice to know somebody's looking out for everybody.
Yeah, that was like his biggest Star Trek crush ever, was Ensign Garavik, so.
That's fair. Mine is Tasha Yar's sister, so. Nope. She was a one-episode wonder.
Mine is Chase Masterson, or Lita, who also happens to be now in universe the first lady of the Ferengi Alliance, I guess, being married to Rom. Where he ended up. And just that, you know, that's a nice segue to, I just want to talk a little bit about like some of the news that came out this weekend from San Diego Comic-Con. Before we start talking about this crossover episode of Strange New Worlds, Dave, I just want to remind everyone, San Diego Comic-Con did happen over the weekend, even though they didn't have like a lot of the big Hollywood studios there. It honestly made me like really jealous of the people who were there, because it would have been more focused on other things. So this would have been like the best year for me to go to San Diego. If I'd known there were going to be these strikes, I totally would have. But all that being said, there were a ton of Star Trek trailers and clips and things that they showed. So me and Aaron broke all those down in a stream we did Saturday. There was a trailer for Lower Decks Season 4, which shows Rom and Lita on Ferenginar, ruling the Ferengi people. So that looked cool.
That's from Lower Decks?
Yeah.
Okay, right on.
There was the trailer for the Strange New Worlds musical episode, a subspace rap study that we'll be covering in a couple of weeks. That's next week, isn't it? Yeah, because there's going to be another episode this week. So
Yeah, man. It's a lot. Yeah. It's flying fast and furious.
And there is the 5-minute clip, like a whole kind of action sequence from Star Trek Discovery Season 5. I'm pretty confident it's from the Season 5 opener premiere episode. Whenever we get that, sometime early next year. So yeah, so lots of stuff. Aaron and I break it all down and also talk about some of his animated series stuff he'd been working on. There was a celebration of the TAS 50th anniversary, and they announced some stuff that's coming with that for Star Trek Day. So please go check out that stream. We cover all of that, and it's, you know, fun to watch like those trailer breakdowns, see all the little things they sneak in there to tease the upcoming seasons and stuff. So please go check those out. And just as a reminder, you know, we'll get back to our normally scheduled programming this week. If you watch the live streams on YouTube, we're still going to have the Thursday night first reaction stream to this week's Strange New Worlds episode, Under the Cloak of War. And then there's going to be a Friday deep dive discussion with me and Dave that will later be released as a podcast. So everything will be back to the normal schedule soon. But yeah, I think that's all the big... Vegas is like next week. It's like I fly in 9 days, I think. So I guess I need to pack my bag sometime soon. So looking forward to Vegas. And then a month after that, we're having GalaxyCon here in Austin. There's going to be a lot of Star Trek actors there. So I'll be at both those conventions. Would love to meet up with people and just be on the lookout for me if you're going to be at either of those. I don't think I have anything else, Dave, unless you have some... burning concerns
any
or
burning sensations,
anything from like the San Diego stuff, like any of the trailers or anything like you want to bring up?
I don't want to sidetrack from it. Like, I think we should stay focused on the what we've got at hand here, which is a big crossover episode. I think we should dive right in. I thought the Discovery trailer was lame.
Oh, well, you can't just like say that and then you have to explain yourself now.
All right. So I don't really watch Lower Decks. So I watched that one for just as a cursory thing. I watched that, and I watched, let's see, what else do we have?
The Subspace Rhapsody.
Subspace Rhapsody. It's just a kind of a teaser. It looked fun, but I couldn't quite take its vibe. Mm. So I'm thinking about it, but I like the musical idea. I'm very much
that's
on
funny.
Board.
I was wondering if it would win you over the same moment in the trailer that won me over, which is when the Enterprise is dancing with the D7, and I'm like, I need this. So
yeah, that looked fun. I definitely caught that. Of course, I wanted that D7 action. I didn't expect a dance would be in it. It with the Discovery sequence, I don't know what other people want from Discovery. I know that the big action sequences are not my thing. And to me, that seemed like a sequence that would seem egregious and over the top in a Kelvin movie. That was my issue. You know, I don't need to see Michael Burnham dodging bullets and stuff.
How would you show like 30-second tech? It's hard to like have like that level of like advanced technology then if you want it to be like, you know, more tame, I guess.
I mean, I just think that was like... That is like a Fast and Furious sequence, you know. In Fast and Furious, it's like they, you know, drive by and grab. They'll reach out the window and grab somebody who's fallen off a cliff.
I've never seen a single one of those. I don't.
That's all right. I'm describing it. Like somebody like got thrown off a car and was going to go off a cliff, and Vin Diesel like skidded right up to the edge of the cliff, almost going off, and he sticks his hand out the window and he grabs their arm and pulls them in, and like that's sort of very normal. That's a tame sort of thing. That's what I felt that, but it's stupid, you know, in any other series. And that's what I felt that they were doing was a Fast and Furious type action sequence. So there you go. But that's just my hot takes on them. I guess I have one negative thing, one neutral thing on Lower Decks, and one mostly positive thing for the Rhapsody, the musical episode. I see in the comments that Jill is ready for Strange New Worlds, so I say we jump into Strange New Worlds.
Sure. Well, I'm going to quickly recap the episode by reading the official synopsis, and then I'll kind of expand on that with spoilers. But the official synopsis reads, an accident while investigating a time portal sends ensigns Beckett Mariner and Bradward Boimler through time from the 24th century, and Captain Pike and his crew must get them back where they belong before they can alter the timeline. That's weird to me that they said Beckett Mariner and Bradward Boimler, but I guess they're like, this is a Strange New World synopsis. People might not know what their first names are or whatever. But
for you newbies, it's Leonard McCoy and James T. Kirk.
Dave, I'll go ahead and let you give like the first kind of opening statement. You might want to remind people like you don't typically watch Lower Decks. You've seen some of it, but
I'm going to lead with that, and I'm going to be a little more off the cuff. Like I told you off air right before this, although I did give it a second view last night, and I made notes throughout the show. The one thing I didn't do, which I usually do, is kind of jot down you know, my first impressions so that they're a little more coherent than just off the cuff. I forgot to do it. Sorry, y'all. So it's going to be more off the cuff, at least for this intro part. But yes, I am not usually a Lower Decks fan. I've tried it. I've watched a whole season and, you know, bits and pieces of lots of other stuff. And it, like, I think it's well done, but that sort of that particular style of very rapid fire jokes. There's a bit in this episode where, you know, when Pike says that he's like it's trying to keep a toddler from knocking over furniture. That's how I sort of feel around like the Lower Decks people. It's like it's too much happening. I feel like something's going to tip over. No, I the humor doesn't get through to me because it's flying too fast and furious. And also some of it just doesn't work for me. It's that particular kind of heightened humor with the stylized characters that they have. It's just not my thing. But, you know, I've liked episodes and liked moments, of course. And I was open to this crossover. And I'm glad I was because it's a super good episode. It's in some ways maybe the most fun I've had with any episode this season. I don't know that I can think of anything that was more fun than that. Father, you have a better memory than me. What else have I liked this season?
Ad Astra Aspera, I think, was the one that you liked the most until
now. It's a little hard to compare them because that is, you know, a very serious episode overall. But if I had to compare it, I'd say they're tied for first place.
Is it fair to say you've been largely unimpressed with this season compared to season one so far?
I was a little like it's had a few more down moments for me, and I was disappointed that some of the stuff that other people were really into, I was not. So for instance, the episode with Spock and his mother-in-law.
Charades.
A lot of people liked it. I wasn't one of them. And a few other ones, you know, there was some middling episodes, like the Land of the Lotus Eaters or Among the Lotus Eaters.
Among the Lotus Eaters, yeah.
Yeah. But this one, man, I don't know. They just hit all the right notes. I think they it feels like they knew that they had to get this right. Kind of like the, you know, when you watch Trials and Tribulations that, you know, you're like, they're like, you know, that's a better episode, frankly. Like that's just peak Trek and you can't beat it. But they had that technology and they knew they had to make it work. Here you have this crossover with a cartoon, with first time Trek thing. If you don't get it right the first time, it's going to suck for everyone involved and you may not get another shot. But man, they knocked it out of the park. I was laughing. I think by keeping it smaller and by having, you know, just essentially two of the characters in there, that made it work better for me. So I wasn't kind of inundated with also like Tendi and Rutherford and stuff like that. And there were these serious moments in it that kind of gave it some gravity, whether it was Pike talking about his dad or this really heartbreaking scene with Christine Chapel, which was so good. And I felt like that those grounded it. And I know there are serious scenes in regular Lower Decks too sometimes, but because it had that hour span, this is like my ideal Lower Decks episode where I would want like a little bit more drama. There's humor in it for sure, but you know, it's kind of grounded by more serious stuff. So yeah, I had a great time and I'm going to call it my ideal Lower Decks episode is live action.
You know, for me, and I do thoroughly love Strange New World. I mean, yes, I love Strange New World. It's my favorite of the current Star Trek shows. But before it was Lower Decks was. I think Prodigy has kind of pushed Lower Decks down to the number three slot. But I still like tremendously love Lower Decks. I had been looking forward to this for a long time. You know, since I guess last year, literally a year ago, when they announced it at San Diego Comic Con last year, when they had Jack Quaid and Tawny Newsom crash the Strange New Worlds panel. So, and you know, we all had been looking forward to it, and it's so similar to like the obvious thing I said at the time when I guess like some people were like, how could that even make sense? Like, what are they gonna? I was like, oh, I mean, I think the obvious thing to do is you bookend it with like Lower Decks and you have animation for when they're in the 24th century, then you send them back in time to the 23rd century, do all the live action stuff there. That's where you have like the sets. That's where you have like all the actors from Strange New Worlds. And then you send your Lower Decks people back to animation future at the end. And that's exactly what they did. So, and a lot of this episode, it was basically like what I was expecting. The part that did surprise me though, was I didn't realize how it was. Sometimes I get annoyed at things that get like a little too self-aware and too meta. I think this is like overplayed these days. You know, like the joke's not that funny anymore. But They used that very well, because, I mean, they kind of looked at Strange New Worlds with that lens, and, you know, like the whole thing, like Boimler being freaked out about smiling Spock and stuff like that. And it was really a Strange New Worlds episode told from the point of view of Lower Decks. You know, we follow Boimler and Mariner. We don't see the 23rd century at all until Boimler is zapped back there. But even though, like, they're the POV characters, all of the important stuff, all of the character stuff, it all comes from, you know, Chapel, Pike, Number One. So I thought that was a really fun. It's almost kind of like the episode Lower Decks of TNG, where it's like we're going to tell a TNG story, but from this very different perspective with these, right, these different characters. They kind of did like the same thing here. So it's true to both the, like, the core of like what like Strange New Worlds is. It is an episode of Strange New Worlds, but also very much like the core, like the original ethos of what Lower Decks as a concept, as a show, was supposed to be, you know, drawing inspiration from that Next Generation episode. And I thought a lot of the, you know, the themes were really cool, like the desire to live in the past and like the nostalgia that we all were so familiar with because it's become so commercialized in the last couple of decades. But juxtaposed against the past isn't as gold as we remember it, or, you know, whatever. It's like, things did seem like cool and great, and we look up to all this stuff from the past, but, you know, people were like a bit more bigoted towards Orions and stuff like that. So, you know, keeping that in mind. And the moral of the story, if there is one, is just kind of like that idea of, faking it until you make it, or just kind of, which I don't know if that's something like I personally agree with like my own, I don't know, like philosophy on how to live life. But I guess it is something like, I think
it's something that works for some people.
It does. It definitely does. I've heard a lot of people talk about how, yeah, they're just like, you know, they know that they're not ready to do what they're going to do, but they just have to pretend that they are, just to hype themselves up and to hype up everyone around them. So
I think it's a kind of a counterbalance to imposter syndrome. If you're just like, sure, well, I acknowledge I'm faking it, but I am somehow doing it, and then eventually you're doing it.
Yes, and as GL47 is pointing out in the live stream, yeah, that was me and Dave were like, is that something someone said in Star Trek or something? Yeah. At least that's what I was thinking.
But, it sounded familiar. I looked it up too, yes. And yeah, I was like, oh, that's an interesting one. That's fun.
Yeah, so Paleo hung out with Cary Grant, I guess.
Sure, she got around.
I mean, like, Doctor Who was married to Marilyn Monroe, so, you know.
By the way, it struck me also that this was like a sort of also a lighter take on some of the stuff from Star Trek First Contact, the meeting Zefram Cochrane, meeting your heroes. It's another sort of variant on that, and also not telling them too much about the future. And it was kind of a slightly more fun version of that. Not that they didn't also have a lot of fun in First Contact.
Let's get to our episode breakdown, just starting with opening with the Cerritos in the 24th century, and then Boimler getting zapped back to the Enterprise. But yeah, the Cerritos has arrived at Kermuth B, and they have a mission to beam down and study this portal that had been discovered by the Enterprise about 120. Actually, if you do the math, it was 122 years earlier. If you freeze frame, Dave, like the first shot that shows Boimler with like his like locker open, it does show the Una poster, the Ad Astra per Aspera.
I tried to do it last night when I was watching it again, and I couldn't quite get it. And I was like, if they made it visible, it was so quick that it was kind of hard for me to freeze frame and do it on, at least with my system.
But yeah, it's funny to me, like they open the episode like Lower Decks. We see like a recap of like, you know, the Strange New World season 2. They even throw in like some season 1 stuff in there. They had like Remy the Orion for some, like, hey, remember the Orions from
right.
season 1?
I mean, that's a smart way to do your recaps, you know, throw in whatever it takes to kind of do the general reminders of stuff on the show.
But then they just go hard into like it feels like an episode of Lower Decks. You have like the Chris Westlake music playing. You have the very, very familiar locations and characters. And one line that made me laugh in there was when they're all excited about scanning the portal, and Mariner's trying to act like she doesn't care, when actually she's the one who like knew they would nerd out about this, and she arranged all of it. But
right. It's the idea of Father E. I think this is probably the case, almost certainly the case, that she just doesn't like to let on that how much she cares and stuff like that. She has trouble expressing her, you know, close feelings and stuff towards people.
Yeah, yeah, it's definitely been like an issue with her that they've kind of kind of explore it a little bit. But when Rutherford is also excited about, like, you know, wanting to, like, scan some tachyons and stuff, and she says, like, man, like, the bar to excite you guys could not be lower. And then Rutherford's reaction to that was, like, pretty exciting, right? Like, yeah, you know, I'm easy to please. That is something to celebrate and be happy about, I guess. So I thought that was funny. But, yeah, the I thought it was cool how they came up with, like, this portal design and kind of, like, this background and how the animation version of it matches up so much with what they... when they get Boimler in the live action world in the past, you know, like one criticism of the AR wall is that it does look like a little fake and cartoony. And I heard Aaron say on our first reaction stream last night, like, look how effective that made it to kind of, you know, streamline Boimler from cartoon world to live action world, you know, with the AR wall.
Yeah, I've only just started to kind of be like, oh, yeah, I can see some downsides to the AR wall now. Like, nothing really serious. Obviously, this is such a high production show, so it's never a serious complaint. But yeah, sometimes I'm like, yeah, okay, for sure. In charades, you know, I kind of spotted it in there and stuff like that.
Oh, when they're talking to
the alien dimension thing, yeah.
Yeah, they do that similar looking environment a bit. Like, that kind of looked like the inside of the comet and Children of the Comet. And...
but you know what, Father? I don't want to say distaste, my sort of disinterest in Lower Decks overall did make me a little nervous with those first few minutes, because I was just like, okay, some of these jokes aren't going to really register for me. It's, you know, this is because it was so Lower Decks. Like you said, it could just be any scene from Lower Decks. And I was like, uh-oh.
When everything turned live action, it stayed Lower Decks so much more than... I guess I was expecting, like, the way that, like, their dialogue is written and stuff, I know it is because, like, they're trying to make the episode work as a comedy, but it felt much more Lower Decks than I would have thought. Almost, like, a bit more than I wanted, to be honest, in a couple of moments.
Interesting. I think, like, stuff like the, you know, I love scanning tachyons. I think, like, that's too goofy for me. I think it's not super funny, and so... you know, no knock against anyone who does. It's just not my thing. But yes, they kept it, and I was reminded that it's not like some jokes when I watch Lower Decks do hit, and this just, like, it seemed to be full of so many hits. It was really, really funny.
And I also like they had the moment in there of, you know, Tindy trying to explain, like, oh, the Orions discovered this, and Boimler being like the
well actually
guy. Yeah, like, actually. And then I liked that Mariner's the one who says, maybe we should, like, listen to Tindy, you know, listen to the actual Orion talk about, like, the Orion stuff. I don't think it was, like, by accident that they had, like, the black woman say that to the, like, the white dude, because like mansplaining and, like, white-splaining is, like, a thing that, like, people do you know, rightfully so, complain about. So
for sure,
it's kind of like a version of that.
Boimler's a good example of, like, how I think you can kind of address it, but he's presented in a benign way. You know, he is broadly usually a doofus, not an asshole. You know, that's not necessarily an excuse for it. Like, everybody needs to be getting better about that. But he's a good vehicle for that kind of thing.
What did you think when he gets to the past, I don't want to call it the past, because it's the 23rd century. We'll just say
it's
23rd and 24th. That's two numbers. But yeah, we get, like, the animated intro, and then we get him, like, on the Enterprise. But
I somehow, during the initial animated intro, when we saw it, I did not notice the Lower Decks, whatever that creature is. Chewing on their ship.
Oh yeah, the space slug.
But that was fun. I of course saw it on the second viewing. And I was on board. Somehow the maybe it was the novelty of it. Maybe it was that it did slow down at least a little bit from the breakneck Lower Deck speed. But, like, I loved his, you know, you're so, what did he say, realistic, and him poking at Pike. This is a great chance for Anson Mount to do more of his comedic timing and his skeptical looks and stuff. I was on board pretty quickly.
I didn't notice until I did the freeze frames for the show. For the video audience, but they added a really cool detail on the bottom of their boots on Lower Decks. They have, like, a little Starfleet Delta, and they actually added that on the bottom of Boimler's boots. You see it when he's laying on the bio bed in sick bay.
Joel in the comments said the computer end program that Boimler did. I like. There were too many good lines for me to, like, jot them all down, but there was endless lines like that in the show. That was a good one. But yes, Father, the that is a neat little touch. I didn't notice that. That's a good catch.
We watched this together, and you pointed out to me, like, wow, like, Jack Quaid is so tall. And you really notice it, the scenes with him and Christina Chong together, because she's tiny, and he's gigantic.
Yes, look at that. It looks like it's CG enhanced or something.
It was one
like
of my concerns. One of my concerns going into this crossover was I knew Tawny would be able to, you know, pull off Mariner in live action, but I was slightly more concerned with Jack Quaid because I always kind of picture Boimler as kind of like, you know, the skinny kind of dweebish guy, and
right.
Jack Quaid is, you know, he's kind of a big dude, but just like. Right. The way that he really went to town on, like, studying, like, the body language of Boimler, I noticed it, like, in the trailers, like, immediately, like, as soon as I first saw moving footage of him, it's like, oh, wow, like, he, just, like, his posture, his facial expressions, he knows how to be live-action Boimler. And then in the Ready Room, he was actually talking about, like, yes, like, I went and watched a lot of Lower Decks, I was, like, trying to pay attention to all the little mannerisms the animators give and try to, you know, replicate some of that. But even just, like, he was able to just, you know, walk down the hall, like, he was able to just, like, hold his body where like he looked like a little scrawnier and more wiry. That it was a more of an impressive job than I was expecting.
Yeah, you know, I think to some degree you just have to deal with like this is just what they look like. It's in the ballpark of the character. It's not perfect, but yes, he like did so much work that it at least you know. I can only say this is the most casual watcher of Lower Decks, but it felt like he made it his own. And he came, the Boims came through in him.
And I liked that they kind of call back to La'an's own, you know, time travel stuff. It, like, it would have been lame if she, like, recapped that entire episode to Boimler, but it also would have been awkward to the audience if, like, she never mentions, like, oh, I, too, was just recently time traveling. So I kind of like that she throws in that, you know, don't form any attachments line and stuff. And it also reminds the audience, like they did last week when they showed her and Paul Wesley have some screen time together again. Like, they're going to pick up on that. If you watch the trailer for Subspace Rhapsody, it looks like, you know, Paul Wesley is going to be back around for that. And there's a lot of, you know, romantic stuff going on in that musical. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah, as an aside, I do hope that I feel like the high water mark is the Buffy musical. Joss Whedon knew his freaking way around a musical and like had that talent, that skill set. But one of the cool things about the Buffy musical was that it was also not just a throwaway novelty episode. He accomplished some big things in that episode. There were some major reveals and, stuff that moved the story forward in a big way. And I'm wondering if we're going to get something like that. Is this Kirk and Leon having their moment? Obviously, the main thing is that they do it well.
Yeah.
If they do it.
Yeah, I think the trailer indicates that that's possible. And the other thing, if I can say, like, one other thing about that Subspace Rhapsody trailer, there's also some, like, kissiness between Pike and Battelle in that. I'm hoping, like, that episode actually makes me care about Battelle, because I'm so...
You're so harsh, Father. No, she's a good character. She's a good supporting character.
To me, she's not a good character, or not an interesting character, but, like, I'm so invested in, like, Spock and T'Pring, and I'm so invested in Spock and Chapel, and I'm so invested in Kirk and La'an, and I just don't care at all about Pike and Battelle.
I say again, so, you cannot compare those. They've all had so much more development.
They need more development for Battelle if they want me to care.
Okay, well, we'll see if that episode gets it. We'll see if that episode gets you.
And then the episode after that, the Gorn will eat her in Hegemony. Mm. But I want to be sad when that happens.
So. I'm aware of your forecasting.
Let's talk about, like, Boimler on the Enterprise and their kind of, like, efforts to try to figure out how to get them back to the future. And how to handle the Orions that they run into. I also laughed out loud when he's, having fun playing with Pike's saddle and is busted by Uhura. I'm not sure how he didn't notice her in the room, but just her line of, like, no judgment.
he didn't notice her because that was animated comic timing, and they were doing animated comic timing in live action. Yes, obviously, that was one of the great lines. I have heard, and I guess this was maybe, was it from the Ready Room where they mentioned, because Frakes was directing it, that he said the Riker.
Yeah, he
Riker.
Improv'd that. And Frakes said that when his wife saw this episode, she cracked up screaming and laughter at that. Because, I mean, think how many times she's seen this guy sit down like that. So.
Oh, man. Yeah.
Yeah, it would have been funny to her.
That's so good. I know that when we were watching, I was like, did he just say Riker?
But, you know, he served under Riker for a little bit on the Titan, so he would have...
That's right.
He knows Riker, like, he's seen it firsthand. So,
yeah.
I love when they do, like, those types of gags, but they actually make sense in universe. The same thing as, like, you look very realistic. It's like, yeah, if you were worried about hallucinating, you would be like, but wait, no, this is very realistic. Like, it would actually make sense.
I don't even mind some meta continuity jokes that they're two-dimensional and all that. But yes, I like that it's one of those, the way it was scripted was such that it also kind of worked within the continuity, the live action, slightly more serious Strange New Worlds continuity. Jill just quoted what was, I think, my actual favorite line in it. Just a little undertone from Dr. Mbenga when after Boimler says that they've been, you know, he's like, oh, I love this old school tricorder. He's like, they never got better than this. They just make it less likely to explode. And he's like, explode, you say?
No. It's not even, he says, like, they never improved on these other than making them smaller and more powerful. Yeah. So it's like, yeah, they totally improve on and less likely to explode. But yeah, like Babs Olu Sanmukun's delivery of that line, I want to hear him say more dialogue and like that funny, like high pitched. But I think he kind of like dials up his natural Nigeria. I know the character's supposed to be Kenyan, but Babs is from Nigeria. Like his natural accent, but yeah, when he's like, "Explode," you said, like at the end, his he has another funny line also.
He gets the closing line. He gets the closing line, and it's a good line too. That, like, one of those all Treks should have such a good line to close with.
But not only is Boimler fanboying with Mbenga's tricorder, he's also pretty excited about, you know, like scanning this portal with Spock, and then he's freaked out when Spock laughs at his remark about dumb luck. Right. That's what I wasn't expecting. I was like, oh, that's clever they're gonna approach the episode from this angle. They're gonna give like Boimler kind of the fanboy reactions to like, wow, this is weird. Why is Spock behaving like this?
Right, he showed up in the one season where Spock was notably kind of not himself.
It's like, I went to Vasquez Rocks the one day it was covered in snow.
Right, exactly.
But I love that. I got like the really unique pictures. That's like, I think this would have been like an awesome year to go to San Diego Comic-Con, because it would have been like the one year it wasn't dominated by, like, you know, Disney and Warner Brother movies. It's like other stuff, like comics.
Right. And of course, the thing with Spock will ultimately set up what was completely unexpected, which was the blow that it will, and we'll talk about it more when we get to it, blow it will deal to Chapel to talk about. But that was, I really like when you can kind of catch me with something completely off guard like that. Boimler is such a big doofus, just a goofball. And you're like, oh, he's gonna, you know, over fanboy about everybody, but it didn't happen the way you expect when he's talking to Chapel.
The Orions show up, and we meet the Orion crew, Captain, I guess the only one we meet is the Captain, and he has that lady who stands next to him but never says anything, but Captain Har Kras, and he says that he does introduce himself as Captain of the Orion science vessel, Devar. This was interesting. I thought this was like a good move in the writing, in that they foreshadow there's going to be something weird with an Orion science ship, and, you know, Tindy and Boimler seem to have like some conflicting information. So they kind of, even if it doesn't like jump out to you as like a big mystery, you're subconsciously going like, I wonder what's an Orion science ship? That sounds weird. And then when they show up here, you know, we're kind of like Boimler. He's the POV character. We know a little bit about these events, but not the full-on details. They gave it a little bit of threat and stakes to the episode by having La'an reiterate to Boimler the importance of not interfering in the timeline, because, like, you could totally screw up the future that you're going to go back to. And so he's worried about, oh, if we get in a shooting match with this Orion ship, Tindy might not ever be born. So,
right.
But I like the way the Orions came off. They were intimidating. They had a cool look.
And they still had like a kind of funny comedic timing, because when Pike was entertaining Boimler, who was kind of telling him, he's like, hey, don't just assume pirates, bro. And then they pirated off with the stuff.
They balanced that pretty well, because you don't want to make Pike look like a bigot, but you also want to tell like the socially relevant story for 2023 about like, yeah, some things in the original series don't age as well.
Right. But these guys were pirates.
Yeah.
And so there's that. I think by this was kind of a, because it is broadly a lighter episode, even though it has some serious moments, I think that was a good way to do it, kind of a light touch to it. Yeah, you call attention to old Trek sometimes being a little bit racist, and yet you do it in a way that Pike doesn't end up looking like a piece of shit. You know, Una pointed out, yep, there's been a lot of pirate activity in this area. And there's some, and I like the guy who played the Orion guy too. He was kind of like, kind of shadowy and oily when he needed to be, and then sort of unexpectedly earnest at the end, which was fun.
Aaron in the live audience is saying that he likes that it also shows societal growth even in the Utopian Federation, and yeah, we should always be trying to, you know, Star Trek should never be like, we've hit the apex of humanity, we've become perfect. It should always be a story about trying to improve ourselves, I think.
Yeah, easy there, Gene Roddenberry. So many Trek stories are about, like, failings, you know, Picard and his white whale, Kirk and the Klingons in Undiscovered Country, just endless stories where somebody has something where they need to grow. So Trek is still doing that. That's one of the best aspects.
They also set up more of a conflict between Pike and Boimler here when Pike does, like, okay, I'm gonna trust Future Boy, I'm gonna do what he says, and oh no, the Orions just ran off with the portal.
So yeah, well, they just, like, boom out of there.
Yeah, they have that. Pike confesses to Una how, like, I thought it was kind of cool that, like, you know, he saw me and doesn't act like my future is all grim and terrible. But also, this guy's kind of an idiot.
Yes. And in fact, she is the one who is worried about it. She's like, oh, he's avoiding me. He's acting like there's something wrong with me.
And it's like, are the Strange New Worlds writers trying to tease something to me, the audience member? Are they trying to tell me, like, watch out, Fathery, we're going to do something to Una, and you might not like it, but it's coming, and it's unavoidable, and we're teasing it now. But, like, no, it was just, like, setting up the joke later, so
yeah.
I liked that. What do you think of the stuff in the port galley of Chapel and Ortega's hanging out with Boimler?
Super fun scene. I like them taking the piss out of him. Boimler is a little bit, I guess, one of those guys who just draws people out to kind of, like, to tease him, to bust his balls a little bit. And they seem to be having fun with it. This is what also got the idea going for Pike's birthday party, right?
Yeah, Boimler accidentally spills the beans that it's Pike's birthday. I felt, like, relatable to this because I'm pretty good at, like, remembering dates and stuff, and I'm also, like, I'm pretty good at, like, not picking up on I don't know, like, not reading the room until it's too late. Mm. So I like, man, like, I totally would, like, show off, like, oh, look, I remember, like, this person's birth date, and it's, like, really important. Yeah, yeah. And then, like, oh wait, I wasn't supposed to say that.
Yeah. Father, I was looking at my notes, and I there was something I jotted down from the opening sequence that Tendi said that struck me, and I just want to, before I forget about it, mention it. It's when she was talking about the Orions, and she says they weren't all pirates, you know, somebody had to make the starships. And I think I thought that line kind of did crack me up, because that is a line that whenever they kind of show you know, any race of aliens on Star Trek that are kind of a bad guy race, or they're supposed to be sort of particularly uncivilized, like the Gorn as well, we're like, oh, the Gorn are just monsters. But inevitably somebody will be like, but they do have light, you know, faster than light travel. Mm-hmm. You know, it's always, they can still build starships. So yeah, I appreciate
it. They could have stolen the technology. I would have always assumed the pirates stole it. I mean, the Orion stole it.
That's just Paklid style.
The Klingons possibly stole theirs when they were occupied by the Herc, who stole their sword of Kalis until Worf and Kor found it.
Interesting. But, you know, there's Klingon engineers, and there's Orion engineers somewhere, and there's Gorn engineers somewhere.
But yeah, that's part of the species diversity.
It was just funny to me that is kind of the go-to trope for, yeah, they're not just total barbarians, they still build spaceships.
It was fun to see Boimler getting the kind of like the Enterprise bingo treatment, like the kind of the light hazing they do under Pike's regime.
Yeah.
You kind of and Pike kind of lets his officers kind of tease him too, so it's like kind of the mood on the Enterprise.
He runs a sort of I guess a more lax bridge than some of the other ones. You know, Jellicoe is not going to love that at all. if he ever visits. But by the way, there's also a little wish fulfillment almost in you know, Boimler as the audience POV character, because who wouldn't want to go onto the Strange New World? Who wouldn't want to go onto the Enterprise and like hang out with Chapel and Ortegas and, you know, Spock and all of these people? He kind of got to hang out with everybody in the crew at some point, or most of the main crew members.
Before we move on, I want to point out that the Andorians in the port galley looked fantastic. My only concern about them is that their antennae don't move. Like, they just stopped doing it. They did that in Star Trek Enterprise, and then none of the current shows have moving antennae. And it seems like, I'm sure it's like a budgetary reason. I'd kind of like if they would like digitally like make them move a bit more or something. You know, with Hemmer, they like rarely made his move. I like how they don't have like the bumpy face, like which Hemmer was one of the bumpy faced people, but they look more like TOS Andorians. So that's another form of species diversity, is just having like the different designs coexist.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, we have more of creepy Spock smile and the panic. Boy, the Boimler.
The screen grabs of creepy Spock smile are really quite intense.
That's a tribute to the work that Ethan Peck was doing and that Jonathan Frakes was doing, and how they shot this. Because, yeah, like, Ethan Peck can smile in real life and not look like a psycho. So.
Right. This is a comedy episode, and they approached it with that in mind.
The heartbreaking scene of... I wanted to stall and not talk about it, but let's rip the Band-Aid off. Boimler and Chapel in the turbo lift. Another thing where I thought Boimler was... It felt relatable when you kind... Like, you say, like, the totally wrong thing, but you did not mean to. And there's, like, you can't undo it. It's like, man, like, I just totally, like, ruined this person's day. Maybe, like, ruined their week. Maybe, like, ruined their relationship. Like, wow. Like, I wish I could, like, go back in time 30 seconds and unsay that.
Yep. And indeed, basically, what she derived from what he said was that, A, Spock is only... Well, he figures out that he's kind of giddy right now because of her, which that is a compliment. But she doesn't really have time to appreciate it because apparently she doesn't even, like, warrant a footnote in anything about his life that people know from the future, and his life is going to become one of kind of known for seriousness. So, like, you know, if she thinks that, you know, she's kind of opening him up to being a little bit more playful and more human and open, it ain't going to last. That's rough.
Yeah, it's rough, and it made me tear up. I think just seeing, like, Jess Bush's reaction to all of this, she, like, sold, like, the pain so well. But the way, like, the camera would, like, linger on her face and stuff, and the way that Jack Quaid was just so, like, oblivious to all of it, just making it worse and worse with, like, every word. Like, no, he is, like, famous for, like, not smiling. He is well known for, like, not being, like, this, you know, this happy, cool, chill dude who hangs out with his girlfriend. Like, I've read everything about him. I know everything about him. I can tell you all about his family. I can tell you all about his pets a lot. And then when Boimler does figure it out, and then, like, that made me feel even worse, because now I felt bad for him and Chapel.
Yep. And she tries to play it off, and she's like, you know, I didn't think it was going to be forever or whatever.
Yeah,
you know,
so not like I even wanted that anyways. And yeah, that was the most gut-wrenching.
She was like, you know, like anybody will kind of in a situation like that when you're giddy with that, you know, with the NRE, new relationship energy. You know, you want to, there's a part of you that is entertaining that idea, even if you don't want to admit it to yourself. So, yeah, heartbreaking moment in a otherwise hilarious episode.
That line that they build up to of her, you know, lying to herself, and it's all in Jess Bush's performance, but you hear it in her voice. She's clearly lying to herself when she says, yeah, I didn't even want, you know, full-on relationship with Spock. Mm-hmm. We know, like, her reluctance to commit to relationships. They set up way back in season one that they brought up again last week. And yeah, so it must have been really special for her to, no pun intended, like, lower her shields and consider Spock, maybe, like, I'll let this guy in. I'll let him get close. And then find out, like, oh, no, like, it's actually not even going to work, so.
Yep. Jill in the audience said, Jess Bush is always so good here and everywhere. Next level actor. And so, yeah, I'm really liking seeing the kind of dramatic turns for her and for Leon. And I forget who's the actress's name? Christina
Chong.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. They've been doing some good, really strong work.
Yeah. And Laan was a character I liked in season one, but didn't have a particular attachment to. But, you know, Tomorrow, it really made me connect with her character. And I'm so invested in her story now. And she's a big mystery because we have no idea what the hell, you know, and Mariner and Boimler, like, they don't seem to give a shit about La'an. They don't say anything about her. So it's like,
yeah,
I don't know.
I did wonder about that. But they did, Boimler did tell Ortegas she's a war hero. Mm-hmm. He threw that one out there. Now, that was from, like, that's something we know about. That's like Klingon war stuff.
Yeah,
right?
they mentioned that in the first episode of the season. She was like pretty hawkish when they were going to that dilithium planet, and you're really concerned about like the Klingons. And you know, in Equality of Mercy, they made her the Styles of the episode, where, you know, he was like very hawkish towards the Romulans in Balance of Terror. Mm-hmm. And we thought that was kind of like out of character for her, but like, oh yeah, maybe if she does have, you know, issues from the Klingon War, she would be pretty vigilant when it comes to the Romulans also.
Yeah, that does make sense.
Let's talk about like the tracking down of the Orions and then kind of the attempted diplomatic solution there. But, you know, Spock is unable to track the Orions. Boimler can do it. They do like the comedy joke of like, let's suggest like the really ridiculous thing that we could never do, and then smash cut to us doing it with the
yes,
we could just not look.
Yeah, he's like, Boimler's what, like, I could track the Orions. Yeah. And they're like, we know you can't, you know, you can't do that. And he's like, what if I did and you just didn't look? And Una of course is like, we can't do that. Can we do that?
No, the temporal prime directive, is this compliant? Would the temporal investigations people say that this was compliant? I don't know, but...
By the way, Father, I was just looking through my notes again. I stopped writing down funny lines because there were too many of it. But early on, when they get Boimler's communicator and they note that, you know, it doesn't, you know, it's a badge and a communicator, and he's like, but flipping it open is the best part.
You know, Pike saw one of those before. Do you remember? Yeah. Season 2 of Discovery, when Ash Tyler is in Section 31, he has one of those. And when we covered that, I brought that up, how like Pike was like, oh, I've never seen a communicator like that. And then, Dave, you made the funny joke of, Pike should have been like, why did you just tap your boob?
I always go for a cheap boob joke. But, yeah. So they track down the Orion and have another awkward convo.
And Boimler has, like, really emphasized, like, you gotta be diplomatic, please do not shoot at these people. So Pike is kind of, you know, you can tell, like, Pike wants to come in here, like, a little bit more cowboy. He wants to be, like,
He
wants to be more guns blazing. And, you know, he's like, it appears you accidentally beamed up the port, you know, like, or something. And then when, like, the Orion Captain Karras, you know, he has a good poker face, but he kind of realizes, he's like, oh, I got some cards to play with here. And he's just like, persuade me. It's kind of a power move.
Right. And Pike's like, how do you want to be persuaded?
Yeah. And the awkwardness with Boimler, like Pike asking the room for suggestions and then being like, not you, to Boimler. And then Boimler telling Spock his suggestion and then Pike being like, I can still hear you, is funny. Then Boimler making a joke about like the size of the bridge. Like, I didn't think you'd hear me over the vastness of the room was funny. Again, because yeah, that's like the double entendre thing. It makes sense in universe. Like, yeah, this is a big room. I didn't think you could hear me from over there. But also, like, yes, fans at home, isn't this bridge gigantic, huh? Like,
yeah, it's pretty clever scripting. I bet there were a few passes on this script to punch it up, punch it up, punch it up, and they got it to a really good place.
And you were mentioning how Jack Quaid was improvising stuff or ad-libbing or whatever with, like, you know, Riker onto Pike's saddle. But Tawny Newsom also, we're about to talk about her introduction to the episode. Yep. She did a ton of that, and it actually landed her a job as a writer on Starfleet Academy, because Alex Kurtzman, he's watching like all the takes they did, and he was watching this like, oh my god, she can come up with like so much dialogue and stuff. Like this girl is a writer at heart. I need to hire her as a writer.
That's, I'll be very interested to hear how that comes out. Something like this makes me more interested at the kind of alchemy that might produce, where you've got some of the comedic energy of the show, but, you know, presumably tempered by live action, the same way this one was, at least somewhat. So I forget what happens with this standoff here.
They trade the grain for the portal, so they have the portal back, but they don't have the grain for the colony, so those people are going to have to be relocated. But yay, we got the portal back. We can send Boimler back to the future. But right before he's about to pass through, Mariner comes back. into the past, or into the 23rd century from the 24th.
I was not keeping close track of, like, the time of the episode while we were watching it, and I knew it had more left, right? And I was pretty sure Mariner was going to show up, and I know that's even the kind of obvious way for it to happen, but I had kind of forgotten, so her just, like, flying through into him was good stuff.
Yeah, and it's like, okay, we kind of did all the funny stuff of, like, Boimler interacting with these people. Now let's, like, now that we've played those jokes, let's freshen things up by dropping Mariner in. I thought that was kind of it's almost kind of how Encounter at Farpoint, like, introduced, like, a bunch of characters on the Enterprise, and then later in the episode was able to introduce a bunch of people on, what was the name of that planet that the Bandy were on? Deneb 4.
Sure.
And the Michael Piller copied that when he wrote the first episode of DS9 Emissary. He had, you know, the Enterprise drop off, or whoever that Nebula class starship dropped off Cisco. Yeah, some people get dropped off there at the beginning, and then they had, like, Jadzia and Julian show up later to kind of, like, split the introduction. They kind of do that here. It's like, okay, we're gonna put Boimler into the 23rd century first, and so that we can show that, and then we're gonna do it with Mariner.
It's a good format. It keeps it kind of lean. It keeps you from having two scenes that are too crowded. I think, by the way, Deep Space Nine, of course, did it better than the Next Gen. But, I think there's a few weaknesses in that Deep Space Nine first episode, too, in spite of its qualities. Here it's even, you know, even tighter because, you know, most of the characters, what they really are, like, there's the initial shot of energy that's Boimler. And then as the episode is kind of reaching a sort of natural, you know, slower moment or what looks like a climax, but actually wasn't. Yeah, boom, here comes Mariner to, like, jack up the energy again. And talk about Hot Spock.
There were two, like, very, like, self-aware lines of dialogue that I thought were, like, just a little too, like, too much.
Which ones?
Well, one of them was here when Una says to Spock, like, their references are very specific. That felt a little, that felt unnatural.
You know, I was so ready for it to be, like, a very over-the-top thing that I didn't even think twice about moments like that. I think I just laughed right along with it. I don't know why. Maybe the live actionness of it made it all somehow more palatable to me. I don't know.
That one bothered me. And then in the shuttle later, when Boimler says, "Have you noticed how everyone talks so slow and quiet in this era?" Like, if they would have just gotten rid of one of those, like, I wouldn't have even brought this up. But just, like, two of them is, like, too many. I gotta complain a little bit.
that's fair. It's funny because to me, I thought those were both good lines, and to me, it's almost because it's a criticism of mine, or not a criticism, but it's just one of those things I don't like about Lower Decks is the rapid fire sort of cartoon dialogue that. You know, them noticing that they're not doing it to me was kind of funny because maybe it was because it, like, it reflects back on, you know, as a very light critique of their own style.
I do have to admit that they are funny lines, though. So I also thought it was funny hearing, you know, we saw, like, Boimler's reactions to Spock. Now we're getting Mariner's reactions to Spock. And it does echo the real life fandom. You know, a lot of people are obsessed with Ethan Peck. I remember it might have been his first Star Trek convention, but it was his first STLV in 2019. And I was surprised that, like, it was the first time he was ever doing, was it the autographs that sold out, or pictures, the photo ops. But, like, at one point they just had to, like, you know, tell everyone in the line, like, no more. Like, he's got to go eat at some point. Like, he can't just stay here for 16 hours taking pictures with y'all.
Right.
It was nuts how popular he was. So, yeah, it was fitting for Mariner to just to be obsessed with Hot Spock. But, yeah, what do you think of, like, that briefing room scene?
Is that the bit where she's like, Hot Spock agrees with me?
Yes.
When she made some point. Yeah. Yeah. By the way, I feel like Spock is solidly hot, but I can't get past the fact that Ethan Peck's, the way Spock's bangs fall, just never quite look right to me because he doesn't quite have, his hair isn't exactly the hair of Leonard Nimoy. So it's like perpetually distracting to me for some reason. But anyway. I'm trying to remember what all happens during this. It's, you know, it's a bunch of good banter. I could only write down so much dialogue.
Well, the important stuff is that Mariner sees it as an opportunity. She wants to go fangirl with Uhura, but she also is trying to be, like, a good wingman for Boimler and get him to hang out with Spock. So she brings up the idea of, like, why don't you just, you know, cook up some more Heronium? Yeah, that's the MacGuffin of the episode, the Heronium that they need for the time portal. It hasn't been seen in centuries. And you know, she being the 24th century girl would obviously think like, oh, we can just replicate it, right? You know, she says, why don't you just cook some up? And Spock's like, oh yeah, we could try to synthesize it. You know, not quite as good in the 23rd century at just, you know, making whatever material you need as they are in the 24th century. But when Spock agrees to that plan, she's like, why don't you have Boimler help you? And this guy's such a nerd, he actually took the class in like synthetic whatever, like, would he actually taken like right. that as like an elective?
So we see multiple times in this episode Mariner quietly going out of her way to be a stand-up bro for her friends. She just doesn't kind of want to some part of her doesn't want to take credit for it, doesn't want to be seen as a person who cares. So that's, you know, if this was your first experience with Lower Decks, I feel, Father, you can tell me if it's a pretty good, do you feel like they'd walk away with a pretty good sense of who Boimler and Mariner are? I feel like they would.
Yeah, I think so. I would be curious to hear anyone who because the show really is approachable, I think, from if you're a Lower Decks viewer and you'd never watched Strange New World, say, because it all is like the point of view of these people. Like you wouldn't know about like, you know, what's been going on with like Spock and Chapel, but neither does Boimler. So I think that would kind of make more sense than if, say, like you're a Strange New Worlds watcher and you didn't know anything about Lower Decks. I think this might be more of a jarring experience, but it's definitely like I said, it was more representative of Lower Decks than I was expecting.
Father, I've got a question here. Jill in the audience says the line about her requiring the grid didn't seem like her. And this is when they imagine, like, if things go badly and they have to go and live off the grid. Mm-hmm. And she's like, I can't live off the grid. I require the grid, or something basically like that. And that did seem a little bit weird, because she seemed like a person who would at least think that about herself, that she would like living off the grid. But, you know, she's actually a very sort of social person.
I think I have like a good explanation for that, but it's actually something I'm going to bring up in the Gorn egg section of the show when we go over all the Easter eggs, in jokes, and continuity connections. By the way, there's a shitload in this episode. I had to get real picky and trim a few out, but I left a lot in, so I think y'all are going to like that. Right, but yeah, we can revisit that there. This is also the time when it's that same conversation in the corridor about like living off the grid, that Boimler runs away. He does like the Section 31 power walk from the second episode of the show, Envoy, the second episode of Lower Decks, Envoys. Mm-hmm. But Una is concerned, why is this guy so terrified? And Mariner says, oh, he has a poster of you. And then she's like, is it like a pinup poster? So I guess like the term pinup poster.
I love how she whispers it. Yeah. I love how she whispers it.
I guess that exists in the lexicon in the 23rd century, but not the 24th, because Mariner doesn't know what she's talking about, but that's okay.
That's true.
That's okay. She's further away from modern day, so it actually does make sense.
Yeah, that was a great, oh my god, why can't I say who plays Una?
Rebecca Romijn.
Rebecca Romijn did a great delivery of that line. She's like a pinup.
Yeah, she's like, so like pearl clutching.
Like scandalized. Like, yeah.
Like, oh my goodness, like, is this like something they'd put in like one of those like dirty magazines, you know, like.
Yeah, it was very cute and endearing. I really liked it.
Yeah, there's kind of a degree of innocence to it almost. Mm-hmm. Uhura and Mariner, having to teach Uhura like how to take breaks and not be so obsessed with work. And
that seems like something in my casual experience with Lower Decks that she tries to do with everybody. So this was very, I would feel like, in character.
Yeah, I agree with her philosophy of like learning the labor rules. It'll help get you out of a lot of work. I that's a great way to live life. It's more important to know how to go into work and do the least amount possible than to go in there and try to impress your boss. But it took me several years to figure that out. And then after I did, it's like, oh yeah, life is a lot better this way. But they do have break time. They have drinks in the port galley, which it's kind of a stealth setup for the big gag at the end. Yep. Of course, we don't know it at the time.
But it works out. And isn't this also where they kind of have their breakthrough?
Yeah, Uhura cracks the language on the portal, and it turns out not even to be helpful, but it does kind of let them bond a little bit. And
oh yeah, that's right.
Part of the thing about like the past, you know, if you actually like go back there and look, everyone's not like as great and high and mighty and perfect as the history books might remember. They, you know, Uhura is supposed to be like this ultimate badass, but she didn't know that she needed to like stop working and stop pushing herself and take a break. So
yeah, Mariner thinks the way she describes her as being like kind of a chill person who knows how to have fun, and then it turns out she's actually a bit more of a workaholic and, you know, really focused person than she thought. Touch more Boimler than she expected.
Yeah, yeah. And she even has, like, that line, like, I'm 22 and I haven't done anything with my life. And it's like, I hear young people say stuff like that all the time. And it's like, of course you haven't. You're 22. Like, you're still a work in progress, you know?
It's yeah,
like
it's crazy to think of her as being just 22. But, you know, the galloping around the galaxy is a game for the young.
Indeed. I like the Spoimler stuff a little bit more with Spock and Boimler in the lab. Trying to synthesize the Heronium. When Spock said, I could use the extra pair of hands if Boimler is not afraid of losing one. And then he does the creepy smile and it freaks out Mariner. And she's like, oh, I see what you mean, but this guy's just full of surprises. But when they have this conversation in here, it doesn't like beat you over the head with it. But if you're paying attention, he actually wanted to get Boimler alone in this lab so he could ask him, hey, what did you tell my girlfriend that made her so upset? Like, we need to talk about that.
Right. Yeah, there were neat dynamics in this episode that I didn't expect it to have, and I really do value being surprised by a show giving me interesting dynamics, as long as they feel organic. If it feels forced, you know, if they're just like, well, we want to put these characters together because we think there'll be sparks, but it doesn't make sense, then that would suck. But they did the work. They had a great scene with Chapel that set it up, so you know, it was all good.
I thought they had like some good Spock dialogue when he's trying to be more human and tease, but he's still like he still says everything in like a very Spock way when he's, you know, he's trying to like freak him out and intimidate him, and he's like do you feel lucky? And he does yes. the Boimler screaming and like her Spark's a bad sign, and Spock's just like, yes, seek cover.
Yeah. I gather that was a fairly trademark Boimler panic scream.
Yes. It was almost jarring how unjarring it was to see Boimler in live action. Like he really like you felt like he looked and sounded like the guy from the cartoon show, but just as live action. Like it worked perfectly. And we have not a ton of Palea in this episode. There's a little Palea. She has like a little bit of talk with one of the time travel kids. Boimler has to remind her, and like, and I'm a man.
Yes. But she did relate the
Cary Grant thing,
serious anecdote. Yeah,
that's, fake it till you make it.
Mm-hmm. And that was really good. It was, you know, I think I liked whenever the show would kind of fall into a slightly more serious mode, because you know, honestly, I almost wish that Lower Decks was like a, you know, 40, 50 minute show like this and was paced like this all the time. Then it would be more interesting to me.
That would kill me having to like those episodes are so dense.
Talking about the podcast. Yeah.
Yes. Yes.
Yes. No. Well, I'm not worried about that. I was purely on a what does Dave like level where they could scenes could breathe a little bit more like this and you know, all of that. Anyway, it's not something I expect to get, but it made me think that I really liked all the serious scenes.
I think there might be more live action Lower deck stuff in the future.
I guess that's true. This I believe is going over very well. I don't know that I've seen anybody who disliked it.
That's what I said. I said that like yesterday in like an online space somewhere, and then like everyone who disliked it like
came
out of
the vast marketplace of ideas.
Generally, yeah, it's gone over.
I feel like 95 out of 100 fans are gonna like it.
I wasn't totally like blown away by it. Like I think I as much as I enjoyed it, I think I might like it like a little less than you, but there's other stuff in season two I liked even more, but you
it
know
it's not quite a blow you away kind of episode.
It's very
like
crowd pleasery.
The plot isn't amazing, and I do think it, you know, if I was looking at it a bit more critically, that it has a few places where it's, you know, loses a little bit of energy and, you know, like a few jokes that don't quite land. But man, you know, I was like I gotta say its average was great.
It's gonna play well to a large group of a bunch of people. It's like what I mean when I say it's like it's very crowd pleasery. Like yeah, it's gonna please a lot of a very large crowd of people. So like I think there's a shitload of people it is gonna be their favorite episode, and mostly everyone else, like it might not be their favorite, but it's gonna be like one that they really like or, you know, speak well about. It's
You know, a crowd pleaser to be sure.
And I would even go as far as to say, and like the people who didn't like it are probably people you were never going to get anyways.
Maybe so. You know, I don't really do Lower Decks, and it got me. So I bet a lot of. Oh, and you know, right, even where I'm recording, my brother's house and his wife, they gave Lower Decks a shot on their own. Didn't particularly fall into it either, but I know at least my sister-in-law really liked the episode. I haven't talked about it with my brother yet, but I bet he did too. So more converts, I suppose.
Nice. Let's talk about like their attempt to fix things. Boimler, I guess, basically decides to hell with the Temporal Prime Directive. I want to get those people their grain so they don't lose their colony they've had for generations. For some reason, Mariner is hanging out in the same shuttle he decides to sneak into to call the Orions. Lon busts their asses when he catches them, you know, in the act of trying to signal the Orions and tell them, like, hey, let's trade back the grain for the portal. But she says that Uhura monitors all the transmissions. Again, like the workaholic Uhura. So if you pay attention, the details all make a ton of sense. But
wasn't that like, this is weird, but like it reminded me of the way they described Uhura in the Kelvin verse, where it's like, oh, I happened to, on my, you know, downtime, I picked up some chatter about
she was a workaholic there too, yeah.
Whatever, yeah, and it was like, oh, that is kind of a thing that came from the Kelvin verse.
I remember that very, very, very vividly, because in that conversation they say that, yeah, this Narada ship, they didn't know it was the Narada, but they said, like, some Romulan ship, it took out 47 Klingon ships.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, I bet you remember that.
And I was like, what, JJ knows 47? This movie might actually be good. But Lon says, yeah, like, Uhura blocked the transmission, but she clearly didn't block it in time because, you know, the Orions do show up. But I liked the way that Jonathan Frakes shot this, where they have Lon marching Mariner and Boimler into Pike's quarters to get their asses chewed out. And the way that the camera kind of stays distant from Pike is, like, they enter the room. And the way that, like, Anson Mount, like, he's chopping up carrots and stuff. He doesn't even want to, like, look up at Boimler and Mariner. He's so, like, fed up with them. And he's like, I'm not even going to, like, stop what I'm doing. I'm trying to, like, prepare this nice dinner. It's not even worth my time to, like, stop this for the two of you worthless asses.
He's dismissive of them, and the camera is visually dismissive of them.
Yeah, and it's like, you are watching something from, like, the point of view of these, like, Lower Decks people. It's like, they're the characters we're following in this scene, not Laan, not Pike. They're, you know, they're, like, off in the distance. They're almost more, like, antagonists that our protagonists are encountering here. But this is where Boimler kind of has his heart-to-heart moment with Pike and talks about, like, yeah, like, as much as you miss your dad and having, you know, birthdays with him, people are going to miss you. This is my other complaint of the episode. I brought up the one they had two lines that were too much for me.
Yep.
I am not crazy about the reveal of Pike's daddy issues. I feel like that's kind of, it's very cliche, like, oh, I'm the same year as, you know, I'm a year older than my dad ever got to be. It's so cliche. In fact, they did this in Star Trek Beyond. This is Kirk's dilemma with McCoy over Chekhov's whiskey in the beginning of Star Trek Beyond.
I think that's a fair call, Fathery. You know, I think at this point I was won over in the episode, and I kind of liked him gently, you know, walking around his own, you know, his own future, and I liked the moment as portrayed. But I absolutely agree. You're right. It is a kind of a cliched trope, and Pike, it doesn't. I remember him talking about his father and his kind of like, wasn't he like was it him or his father who was like a theological studies guy, and I didn't particularly remember that there was, like, an antagonistic thing with them. Has that ever been mentioned before?
No, that was an invention of this episode.
But as Rachel says in the audience, I like that he has a nice, serious moment. And that's kind of how I think I felt about it. I was like, oh, I like how this works in the story. I like the, you know, I like the way it hits the structure, and Anson Mount can handle that material well. So Jill makes an interesting point. Sometimes it's easier to talk to strangers. That's a very known phenomenon.
Yeah, that for sure rings true. I just wish they gave him, like, another reason of why he was sad on his birthday than the exact same reason they gave Chris Pine to be sad on his birthday in Star Trek Beyond.
Yeah. Like, maybe he could be sad because his girlfriend was devoured by a Gorn.
There's a joke in there about Boimler when he says, yeah, sometimes, you know, visiting the past can be difficult or something like that. And then I got a pretty good laugh out of me when Mariner says, like, yeah, I didn't even want to be here.
Hey, Fathery, as I'm looking at this screenshot, are there uniforms that they're wearing? Are these uniforms we've seen before in other Star Trek stuff, like in Picard or something? Or just in
Lower Decks.
But we haven't seen them live action until this?
I mean, at Star Trek Mission Chicago, they wore this, okay, but not in any TV show.
Did you like the look of them?
I wear this uniform sometimes. I have one of these.
Okay, but, you're more of a uniform guy than I am. But I thought they looked good.
It's actually one of my favorite uniforms, except I don't like that it's a different comm badge. I wish it was just like the standard like Voyager First Contact DS9 Season 3 comm badge, which would have made more sense in my opinion. But I guess seeing them here, they do look like pretty sleek and advanced, like especially when like Pike and Una are like looking at the comm badge, they're like, oh, look how advanced this future technology is. So it kind of made me like it more, to be perfectly honest. But yeah, it's still, even that aside, yeah, this is one of my favorite Starfleet uniforms in all of Star Trek. And I don't have a perfect uniform. There's something that bugs me about each one.
Yeah, that's fair. That does seem to be the nature of it. There is not a perfect uniform, but as a tapestry, it's pretty good.
But yeah, I like the uniforms that have a lot of color that aren't mostly black. Tend to be my favorites. I like a bright, colorful future. I like wraparound uniforms.
A little bit of black is a good offset, like the slacks on the original uniform, or they have accents of they have black on these uniforms too. Like the pants and then also the upper.
Yeah, then shoulder. Like the shoulders are black. Yeah, I prefer these over like the TNG uniforms, which is what they're pretty close to, and I much prefer these over TNG. But they do another thing. I kind of complained about it last week last episode, which was only a few days ago. Lost in Translation, when Uhura hears Himmer in the YouTube tutorial she was watching say, burn out the receiver, and then she figures out, like, oh, they burnt up that guy's brain trying to communicate with them. And
say that again? Receiver?
But it's here when Pike talks about, like, you know, I can picture what it'd be like if I went back in time to Archer's Enterprise. They don't make them like they used to anymore. And then Boimler's like, you're right, they don't make them like they used to. But this one I liked felt a bit more natural than what I was complaining about in Lost in Translation. But yeah, he remembers that there is Heronium on board the ship after all. I see Joanne mentioning the Scorch, which I know is like a Twitter account that for the oldest piece of the Enterprise, which I guess isn't really the oldest piece of the Enterprise, but we met that hull plating in Season 1. But I guess it's like the oldest part on like the outside of the ship. This is the oldest part on the inside, I guess, but it's part of the NX-01 was used in construction of the 1701. They've never said anything like that in Star Trek before. I guess this is a new addition to the canon.
It seemed like a kind of a fun, you know, naval tradition.
There's actually a bit of this setup in Picard Season 3 when they took Riker's old Titan and turned it into a new Titan, but then that gets turned into like the Enterprise. So to make it an Enterprise, they have to take part of the Enterprise F that Shelby blows up and dies on. They had to like merge that into the former Titan, now the current Enterprise.
They actually put her corpse in a bulkhead.
It's like, why is there like a tooth and some blonde hair melted into this plate of metal? Oh, that's Admiral Clancy, where she blew up, you know, in the Borg.
Good old tradition.
When the Borg tried to crash Premiere Day, or what? Well, they did crash First Contact Day when they went back in time to the original First Contact and tried to blow up Zefram Cochrane. So those Borg, just a bunch of party crashers, but. Speaking of like time travel shenanigans, though, and First Contact and all that, there's some Enterprise love with
Ortegas
and Uhura. She
talks about Travis and
Hoshi.
And Hoshi, yeah, I like that. You know, I haven't seen Hall of Enterprise. That's on my project list. But I've got some fondness for it.
You know, there's going to be like less new Star Trek to cover the next couple of years, it looks like. But it's not necessarily a bad thing. There's plenty of old Star Trek, Dave, and I have never talked about. I'm curious if anyone is interested in Star Trek Enterprise, if that's a show that
we should revisit. Infamously divisive, and but certainly
less so now. Like, it's the people who
everybody rediscovers every Trek at some point, and that one seems to have gotten at least some renaissance.
I guess now that they have a solution for the time portal, they're going to get Mariner and Boimler back home. They can clear things up with Number One. Boimler is, you know, he's kind of making a mess of things when he first showed up. Now he's like making it right. He said the right things to Pike, and he says the right things to Una here. She's like, oh my god, I totally have to call you out on your flagrant disregard of temporal protocols, but also thank you so much for letting me know that I'm actually like remembered fondly by history. That means the world to me.
This is so sweet. And I felt like the wink she throws them is everything. Like if I was them, I would be like, my day is made.
I would die if Rebecca Romijn winked like that at me. I would
100%. 100%.
And then I know they gave it away in the trailer, but it is super funny. The Boimler dropping the ball with Spock doing the famous catchphrase "Live long and prosper, Mr. Boimler," and then not being able to come up with a reply to that.
Right, he stammers his way through it. I think it was probably a good one to put in the trailer to kind of catch, give you a hint of the vibe. It's a little too bad because it would have been great to see that cold, but you know, that's okay.
So they beam down, the Orions are there, so they clearly did get the message, but it's okay. They agree to the trade as long as the Pike comes up with the compromise of, like, what if we say that it was discovered by Orion scientists? He only knew that because, you know, Boimler is making a big deal about, like, no, like, in the future, we say that this was discovered by Orion scientists. So, like, when he's like, you know, I know for a fact this is an Orion science vessel. So we thought this guy was going to be, like, pretty nefarious. It turned out, like, oh, he just wanted to be remembered as a scientist instead of a pirate. Like, that's kind of respectable.
What do you say? That's all I ever wanted?
Yeah. It's also funny when they're talking about, oh, yeah, we know that there's a attendee on your ship. And he's like, yes, Astrea Tindy, and she serves on my ship. How could you possibly know that? And the Mariner being like, yeah, but like we keep telling you, we're time travelers. I feel like you're not listening. They end on the Orion Hurricanes. Before they do that, they do like the end cap on the lower decks side of things, where we see them on the Cerritos, and we get the realization from Ransom that, like, Mariner fought for the portal mission because she knew, like, her friends would have a fun time looking at a boring old portal.
Mm-hmm. Yep. So she's a sweetheart after all. And then, yeah, we get to see the Cerritos once again.
Yeah, so Anson Mount told us about this a while back. He teased, like, yeah, you might even see an animated Pike in this episode. So I was kind of thinking, like, someone might actually, like, go to the future, might actually go to the 24th century from the 23rd century and be on the Cerritos and, like, see, like, Shax and Ransom and Captain Freeman and all of them. But no, they just kind of did, like, this little fun thing at the end of showing Lower Decks style animation of the Strange New World characters and Enterprise, and, you know, the funny joke about the Orion Hurricanes, where they're made with real Orion Deloc, which Mariner did warn, like, yeah, that stuff will ruin your life. You know, I guess she figured it wasn't worth, like, going into detail what the, you know, these people aren't going to get that, any of that stuff anytime, so you don't need to tell them it's, like, an incredibly strong hallucinogenic. But they learned that Ortega's obviously, like, saying, like, do my eyes look real big? They feel real, you know, they look like cartoon characters. But yeah, it's
I was having a lot of fun with this scene. It was, you know, the episode had earned its funny, goofy send-off, absolutely, and they did a great job with it. And here comes Mbengo with the line, how to go, Father E.
What the hell is in these things?
Yes. You know, earlier somebody was saying in the comments that this is going to be, you know, a great watch-along kind of episode with fans, and somebody, I think, I don't know if it was Joel, somebody was like, you know, and drinks, and I do think it'd be a fun episode to watch with some cocktails floating around. So yeah, that's the silver line, you know, the extra sprinkles on the episode at the end.
I did like this little cap, and I'm glad that they did this, but my preference would have been that they did, like, this whole final scene in the animation style of the animated series instead of... I think how, like, perfect that would have been to, like, come out, like, this year during that show's 50th anniversary.
I mean, it would, but, I guess it would lose the sort of the purity of the two-episode crossover and, you know, potentially confuse fans.
I should say that I would have preferred they do that, but then at some point in a future season of Lower Decks, do a Strange New Worlds crossover, but some of those people go to the future and they're on the Cerritos animated.
Right. I mean, I suspect we're going to see something like that at some point. Well, that seems like, you know, the kind of follow-up that they would do.
They've really, like, held off on doing, like, their first big crossover for... I mean, like, they started making new Star Trek again in 2017 with Discovery. They had multiple shows since early 2020 with Picard and Lower Decks coming out that year. And it's only, like, just now in 2023 that they're actually crossing some of these shows over. But it's something that I think that they'll do more. And I keep saying, you know, if they're going to do, like, a big Avengers-style event where they get, like, everyone together, we're eventually going to hit episode 1,000. We're about to hit 900. We're going to hit 900, I think, during... We don't know when Prodigy is coming out. Hashtag save Star Trek Prodigy. We don't know when that's coming. But if we don't have it by the time we get Disco Season 5, we'll hit 900 with Disco Season 5. And, you know, if there's episodes coming out, like, every week, you know, I know that there's not going to be next year, but when there is, like, it's only, like, 2 years is, you know, 104 weeks. Like, it's not going to take long to go from 900 to 1,000. So, you know, it'll probably be, like, at least 3 more years, but eventually we're going to hit that 1,000 episode. I think that'd be like a wonderful excuse to get whoever, like anyone from any show. You just have them all like together for like
right.
one big,
it's time to
one
see
big story.
Kira again and all the rest. You know, like
yeah, let's have Kira
bust
and
out Archer.
Archer,
let's see Travis
and,
too. Yeah,
and have Chekhov and Sulu in there if they're if they're still wanting to.
We can find it. Yeah, if we can do it. Father, you, I was thinking, I was like, you know, what'd be fun is like to do a Strange New Worlds Discovery crossover. And I was like, that's where Strange New Worlds started.
Yeah.
God, what am I doing?
But it is cool to see like how connected the whole universe can be. I always love feeling like that this is all part of like one big shared universe. I grew up, you know, really into Star Trek, but also really into like Marvel and DC comics. And yeah, like I think, you know, the reason why the Marvel Cinematic Universe became like the most valuable movie property ever of like all time is because, yeah, people do get a thrill out of seeing those, you know, vastly different characters and stories of how they can like coexist and what like a cool, fun place that is to have all this different stuff. So I like that Star Trek kind of like wrote the book on how to do that in like TV and movies at the same time.
It's true. It's true. Credit where deserved.
Well, that's all I got. I think it's time to go into the Gornegg section of the show. Again, this is going to be a lot, but I'm going to...
Yeah, let's hatch this nursery of eggs.
I'm going to do it 24th century style instead of 23rd century style. So it's going to be... I'm gonna talk fast and loud. But yeah, these are the Easter eggs in jokes and continuity connections I thought would be worth mentioning. Starting off with Boimler trying to explain the portal was discovered by the original Enterprise, but not the original Enterprise, actually the second Enterprise, trying to explain how to refer to the 1701 now with the NX-01 existing in fandom. This is kind of a nod to the Deep Space Nine crossover episode, another big crossover episode, but Trials and Tribulations, when you have the Department of Temporal Investigation dudes and they're asking Sisko, like, which Enterprise was it? Sisko is like, it was the first Enterprise, which now kind of doesn't make sense because of Enterprise, where we see right. Archer's Enterprise. So a little acknowledgement of that Enterprise confusion. Rutherford's Hollow Imager, which we've seen on Lower Decks before, but we've never seen it on Strange New Worlds before. But yeah, it looks like the Voyager Doctor's Hollow Imager, kind of like the same prop that he had. Boimler names drops a couple of episodes as he's being zapped through the portal. Right before it activates, he says, you know, Starfleet used Heronium in the original NX class. It's lightweight, it's durable, and it's just the right shade of gray. I think that was meant to acknowledge the TNG episode Shades of Gray. And then there is the TNG episode Remember Me, where you see Beverly Crusher zapped through a portal. And here we have Boimler scream out, remember me, as he's being sucked through this portal. That's when Beverly was in like that pocket dimension that kept shrinking.
Right.
Dave, as you pointed out, the space slug from the Lower Decks opening credits is seen in the Strange New Worlds animated opening credits.
Father, is that actually from an episode, or is that just only
the
credits?
No, it's just in the opening credits.
I need to see it. I need to know its story.
They also show the Cosmic Koala in the in credits there. That was the
I caught that the second time. I was like, what? I was like, what am I seeing here?
Yeah, that was the creature that was first introduced in Moist Vessel during the ascension to godhood. It's the universe is balanced on the back of a koala who's smiling for some terrifying reason, whatever he knows.
When I looked it up, I think I saw there had been a number of references to it over Lower Decks.
The grain that they trade with the Orions is triticale.
Yep.
Obviously a precursor to the quattro triticale that we see in Trials and Tribulations, which
right.
played a role...
Or rather, in Trouble with Tribbles.
In Trouble with Tribbles, which and also played a role in Trials and Tribulations,
yes.
The other big crossover episode that they're acknowledging a lot in here. Setlik 2 is where that grain is supposed to go. So Setlik 2, they also mentioned that in like the first episode of Strange New Worlds, but that's going to be like the same system as Setlik 3, where O'Brien was fighting the Cardassians and under Captain, what's his name on the Rutledge? Maxwell, Captain Maxwell.
The guy who would later kind of go rogue.
Yeah, from TNG's episode, The Wounded.
Great stuff.
Also another TNG reference when Boimler promises not to have any more future spoilers in his outburst, Worf's honor And he's like, oh shit, they're not supposed to know about Worf. we talked about how he shouted out Riker when he Rikered on to the saddle doing the Riker maneuver. Boimler talking about the 23rd century tricorders and how they were more likely to explode. We see a 23rd century tricorder explode in the episode Arena when the Gorn lock onto Spock's tricorder and make it overload and blow up. When Boimler steps onto the Enterprise bridge, he remarks how it's the NCC-1701-nothing. Pointing out all the, as Scotty would say, no bloody A, B, C, or D. I was so happy to see the Orion ship. It looks like the Orion ship from the Star Trek original series remaster version of Journey to Babel. Back in the original version of Journey to Babel, is just kind of this flickering light. So when Mike Okuda went through to add like the modern special effects for the TOS remastered, he made it have like the spinning wheel of light. So it's still kind of like that same like flickering light effect. And they do a very good job bringing that to modern Star Trek with this episode of Strange New Worlds. Mariner makes a reference to Deep Space Nine when she says, "For all I knew, you were dead or stuck in a dystopian San Francisco in the middle of a riot." Obviously talking about the time Sisko and Bashir went back in time to the Bell Riots in DS9's Past Tense, Parts 1 and 2. They also mention Spock's pet Saylot a couple of times. Boimler, when he says he's read every book on Spock to Chapel, and then Mariner, when she's like, "Oh, please tell me you didn't ask Spock about his pet Saylot." And that same conversation where she does talk about living off the grid, I think what they're actually talking about, Dave and GL47 and anyone else listening, is in Star Trek First Contact, when they think they're going to have to blow up the Enterprise E and stay stranded in the 21st century, Picard gives orders to the crew of everyone to like stay out of history's way. Basically, you're going to have to go somewhere where you're going to be out of sight, out of mind, and have to be incredibly like uninvolved with anything or anyone. I think that's like a temporal protocol if you're stuck in the past. I guess there's people who've actually had to do that. And yeah, I think that's like Mariner is fine, you know, kind of being like out of Starfleet, off doing something else, but not something where she has to like stay, you know, like hidden and quiet. She would definitely not thrive well like that.
Right. Her just on some little deserted island or in an isolated village.
So this is a really cool detail that I haven't heard anyone else bring up yet. So if I can just, pat ourselves on the back a little bit. We are pretty quick on covering like these new episodes of Star Trek. I know like a lot of people who do weekly coverage of new episodes, like podcast wise, like a lot of people like who cover Thursday episodes, like they don't even have that out on, you know, Mondays when we're doing this now. Like there's people like, hey, they haven't even had time to cover Lost in Translation. We're already onto the next episode. So, you know, one of the things that like I'm happy to share that like I noticed in this episode, I don't know if anyone else did, Uhura's studying like Cardassian and Bajoran language on her pad, trying to decipher these time portal markings. So clearly, like, they don't know Cardassians or Bajorans too well if they don't have like a good handle on this written language. I don't know if they have like official first contact with these people. They're clearly like aware of them. Okay, that's cool. But that means that this portal is probably somewhere near Cardassian and Bajor space. They were on a mission to go to Sutlik 2. That's where that colony is. We know that's close to the Cardassian border. And so the Cerritos is near that planet in the 24th century. If you pay attention to the star date they give during Boimler's log entry in the opening of the episode, this episode's actually set in season 3 between episodes 5 and 6. They're visiting that portal on their way to DS9. That planet is, we have confirmation it's close to Cardassian space in both the 23rd century and the 24th century, and I just think that's like really cool attention to detail that I am surprised that they put that much effort into it, but I mean, yeah, like
it's, yeah, that's cool. That's a nice bit of continuity.
And I'm looking forward to rewatching season 3, episode 6 of Lower Decks. Here, I'll trust nothing in our Patreon watch party soon. But yeah, that's that'll be fun watching it now. Like being like, this happens right after they went back in time and met Pike.
Yep.
So that's cool. Right after they go back and meet Pike, they go to DS9 and meet some DS9 people. Next up, the Starbase Earhart is mentioned. That's where Picard was stabbed by Nausicaans. And they also visited it in the Lower Decks Season 2 episode, We'll Always Have Tom Paris. I liked Mariner's joke there about, yeah, like, Nausicaans, they suck at Dom Jot, but they love betting people. It's like, yeah, like, you know, they had to cheat at that and then, like, got mad and stabbed Picard when he figured out they were cheating or whatever. But they mentioned both Q and Trelane in the shuttlecraft. When Boimler is scared by Mariner and yells, "Holy Q," and she's like, "You can't talk about Q in the 23rd century. They had the Trelane thing going on instead." So that was cool. It's like even in universe, people have noticed similarities between Trelane and Q, just like we have in the fandom.
One of the I think one of the Trek novels, I want to say it's called like Q Squared, or maybe is that an episode?
That's a pretty well known. This a Peter David one, right? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That one went ahead and solidified the link between them and some other stuff too.
Yeah, but, Chris Roberson did it in one of his Star Trek comics.
Yeah, it's a fair and fun connection to make, I think.
There's a lot of Enterprise fandom, actually, because we get to see La'an, who normally has a stick up her ass. She kind of nerds out about, like, oh, I love grapplers, when they're talking about the grapplers on NX-01. No, before they had tractor beams, they had grapplers. And shout-outs to Travis Mayweather and Hoshi Sato, as we pointed out. But yeah, the two characters are a little underserved in that show, so I'm glad that they were given a shout-out by two people of color on this crew. Pointed out the two people of color in the Star Trek Enterprises crew. When they're talking to the Orion captain and trying to convince him that they are from the future and they know about the people on his ship, they refer to Tindy's nickname, also from We'll Always Have Tom Paris, the Mistress of the Winter Constellation.
I wondered about that.
Sounded cool.
Yeah.
And then referring to the mid-23rd century as, like, the TOS era, or, like, those old scientist era, that was something that Ransom said when they visited Beta 3, the planet from Return of the Archons, way back in the Lower Decks episode No Small Parts in Season 1. And then I thought it was... That I kind of don't know how I feel about, like, TOS, but I think people say it. Like, those old scientists, it's not, like, a great, like, I wish they kind of thought up something better.
It seems to fit the Lower Decks stuff to me pretty well.
The funny suggestion that I have heard is that they should call, like, the TNG era those new guys.
Yeah, that's pretty good. I honestly think it's kind of funny that it's kind of awkward.
Yeah.
I think that's what I felt
about it the first time, but, like, the more they say it, the more normalized it becomes. Like, I don't know, I think the less I like it.
Well, like, if, you know, this is how I sort of feel about a lot of the goofy stuff in it. If I were to be reading on, you know, the wikis for it, and it's like, you know, historically, people, you know, in the era of, you know, whatever, I forget the exact where they are in Boimler and Mariner's time, you know, referred to this as the TOS era. I'm like, yeah, once it's written down as, like, historical fact, it sounds dumb. Yeah. In the context of the show, it's funny.
I did love that they acknowledged Rebecca Romaine and Jerry O'Connell's real life marriage. When Ransom was like, oh, wow, like, number one, yeah, she's, like, the hottest chick in all of Starfleet. And it's like, yeah, because, like, they're married in real life.
Yeah.
But that's all I got for Gorn Eggs. I know that people have a ton of opinions on this episode. I saw some really fun discussion in the live chat tonight from our live audience. I would love if people would comment on YouTube or reply to my tweets on Twitter or talk to us in the TexTrek Discord server or the TexTrek Facebook page and let us know how you felt about this episode, those old scientists. Dave, do you have the subspace transmissions we received on last week's episode, Lost in Translation?
Yeah, I do. I've got just a couple comments to read today. Let's see, Lost in Translation, that was the one with the spooky,
Zombie Hemmer.
Zombie Hemmer, Ghost of Zombie, or is it Ghost of Hemmer, yeah.
Zombie Hemmer and Kirk Bros.
Right. So first from our own recurring colleague, Sohail, who in this tweet I was identifying as Mistress of the Winter Constellation himself, says, better every time I watch, and we get some iconic moments that I've been waiting to see on screen. I know we didn't get their first meeting the way some of us thought it would happen, but I actually appreciated the way it was done more. And so that was, of course, I guess the Kirk Spock Uhura first meeting that I'm sure he's referring to there, which was, yeah, really a lovely but underplayed scene. It wasn't like, you know, no fanfare, no trumpets, just a kind of a handshake and a what we bring to the table. And then I'm going to not be able to say this person's name because it's just like at and like a string of numbers and letters. But the comment said, this was one of my favorite episodes to date. I love seeing Uhura front and center and having a story center on her. For me, this has been an up and down season, but I was left on such a high after this episode, despite knowing in the first 5 minutes what was going on at the oil refinery, which she says is, which is clear to anyone who saw the 1990 Jetsons movie, a favorite of mine. Very specific reference. I did not see that movie, so I did not know what was going on. Oh. But she concludes, even knowing that, I was enjoying the journey to their discovery. So yeah, that seemed like an episode that I think caught people surprise by surprise at how fun it was, despite the freakish zombie hammer. And that's all I've got for Subspace Transmissions this week.
Cool. Well, thank you so much to those folks who left us some feedback on last week's episode. And I have to say that it's fun to close out the show on a high note with a very generous gift from Joanne Robertson with a $10 super chat. Thank you so much. Joanne says, thanks for the hard work and the quick turnaround, Father Ian Dave. Well, we love doing it, so... It's very, very rewarding work.
Yeah, absolutely. And this was a great episode to chat about and see people reacting to and pulling all the quotes. It's a super quotable episode.
Yeah. If we hated the episode, this would have been like a lot harder. But yeah, we.
Yeah, it's honestly a bit of a relief for me because, you know, me and Lower Decks don't always get along. So but I had such a good time.
It's funny, like the minute that I finished work on text truck number 250, I had to start work on text truck number 251. Like, I just like got like the podcast edited and distributed, and like, okay, now it's time to start like getting notes and getting screenshots, getting the whole process started for 251. And
it's been, you know, sometimes our hobbies are like second jobs. Yeah, and
then
at times
that I'm gonna have to do, like, as soon as I'm done with this one, it's gonna be time to start on a Thursday's episode, Under the Cloak of War, which I'm looking forward to talking about. I cheated, Dave. I've been dreading, like, I don't want like full blown like Gorn War, which I'm scared we're headed towards. I was hoping this wasn't going to be like I know we're getting something gorny in the season finale. I might love it. I might hate it. I don't know. I'll wait then and see what I think. But I was hoping that episode 8 would not be too gorny. It's written by Davey Perez, the man who put the word youngling in the Star Trek universe. He did like the Gorn episodes in season 1. But Under the Cloak of War, to me, that sounds like, okay, Romulans or Klingon. So I normally never watch the Ready Room clips until I'm ready. You know, I like to watch the episode without knowing those. But I always watch the Ready Room every week. So today, like, when I watched the last Ready Room, I went ahead and watched the clip. So
yep, I've done that every once in a while.
Well, I'm not going to say if it's Gorn or Klingons or Romulans, but the clip they showed on the Ready Room definitely confirmed it was one of those.
Okay. So. I may watch that clip myself. We'll see, because I want to watch the Ready Room for this one. I have not done that yet this week. I didn't get a chance to, but I usually do when I've got time. And this one in particular, I feel demands to be seen because it's such a, you know, an insider fan friendly.
Yeah, episode. And it's Will Wheaton's talking to Jonathan Frakes, Tawny Newsom, and Jack Quaid. So you got the director and the two guest stars. So
all three at once, Father.
Yeah, I'm just gonna spill the beans because they're already promoting the episode. It's only like a couple days away at this point. But yeah, it's Klingons. So yay! Okay. I love Klingons. Okay. I know some people get tired of all the Klingon episodes, and they're all like, boo, it's Klingon. But I'm like, yay, it's Klingons. So I'm looking forward to seeing Klingons with, now that they have, like, their cool look back and have some Klingon fun. So we got Klingon episode, then we have, like, a musical. That's going to be weird because Vegas next week. But we'll still have the show out. We have Klingons musical and then a Gorny finale.
Yeah. That is quite the, you know, we'll see if we get whiplash from all this tonal dissonance, but yeah, it's gonna be a ride.
Yeah, and I like a show that can shift the tone all over the place. I love DS9 going from, you know, heartbreaking tragedy one week to goofy Ferengi shenanigans the next week to like big battle action the next week and just all over the place like that.
So. As ever, if you do it well, you can get away with anything.
But yeah, looking forward to more Star Trek talk coming in the coming days. And until next time, as always, live long and prosper, y'all.
Listen to the Text Trek podcast through Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or at text-trek.com. Like us on Facebook at facebook.com/text-trek. And follow Fathery on Twitter at TXTrek. Please support us by liking our videos and subscribing to our channel on YouTube. Thank you and take care.